views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good morning. You're listening to Battlefield Expressions. This is Senior Chief Rob Burrows, Director for the Northern California Veterans Museum and Heritage Center, and United States Navy CB veteran, two combat tours in Iraq. And my privilege to be with you this morning and to talk about our veterans and the history of our veterans and things that are going on in our community. And I think we have a really good program for you this morning. You know, the last couple of weeks have been replayed shows, but we're out taking care of veterans that are in need. When I'm not here on a weekend, we're out taking care of a veteran that was in need. So last week, our staff for the Homeward Bound there at the museum was out taking care of an Afghanistan veteran and her family who had lost a son. And so we were taking care of them with some meals for the funeral and different things like that. We are constantly in the community helping those that are in need in one manner or another. And so when I'm not here, I'm not like out water skiing or snow skiing or someplace that I maybe want to be. We're in the community stepping out and we're helping others that are in need and taking care of that. Sometimes that requires us to not be here on a Saturday. And so this morning we're going to be talking about World War II veterans, Korean War veterans, and our Vietnam veterans as we continue to memorialize and remember our Vietnam veterans for the 25th anniversary, the 50th anniversary of the wall and the Vietnam War, and to say thank you to them. You know, we're losing our World War II veterans so fast. There's only 2% of our World War II veterans that are still left alive in the United States that are living, and that number dwindles every single day. And our Korean War veterans, we're losing them in a staggering number. And also, we're continually losing our Vietnam veterans due to the Agent Orange issue that caused them to lose their lives sooner than a normal living life because of cancer and because of different issues that Agent Orange has caused. And that Agent Orange continues to carry on in family members also. Babies that were born because of the exposure of the Agent Orange, those things that are also taking place. So it doesn't always just affect the Vietnam veteran, but it affects the children of the Vietnam veterans also because of that chemical contamination that they were exposed to by our government. And so it's so important for us to remember and honor our Vietnam veterans. For those that serve and were susceptible to the exposure of Agent Orange, and then to remember that their family is susceptible to that also because it goes into the blood system, it goes from there into the DNA, and from the DNA it's transferred to the child, male or female. And so it's very important for us to remember and honor these veterans as they live with us in our community, they're around us. All of our veterans are so important, and to make sure that they're not forgotten, especially how they were received back home during that time frame. I wanted to read a quick article to you. It is concerning our veterans' homes across the United States, or actually across California, and it's concerning our World War II veterans. And it's about the ruptured duck, which is a pin that was issued for our World War II, World War I veterans at the end of the war for honorable service. The ruptured duck honorable discharge pins finding lapels in CalVet veterans' homes. And that includes our home right here in Northern California, over there off of Knighton Road. A few weeks ago, the Veterans Home of California Ventura received a phone call from Lou Zayas, junior commander of the Military Order of the Purple Heart Chapter in Georgia. Zayas wanted to know the number of World War II veterans living at Ventura Home. He wanted to send each one a ruptured duck lapel pin that represented an honorable discharge during World War II. Zayas made the same call to the other seven veterans' homes in CalVet system. Of course, the Ventura staff accepted this gracious gesture. When the pins arrived soon thereafter, the home's seven resident World War II veterans received their pins individually because of the current COVID-19 safety protocol. Discourages gatherings and ceremonies of a greater number of individuals. No matter, They were thrilled to get them. In fact, one resident, Marine veteran Art P., recalled receiving one long ago, but has no idea what happened to it over the years. He now wears the replacement pin proudly, as do all the other World War II veterans at the home. Honoring our veterans symbolizes the bond that many of us had on the battlefield, said Ventura Home Administrator and Army veteran Julian Bond. That includes remembering the past and honoring the present. Mr. Zayas' generosity brought smiles and tears of gratitude to our World War II veterans. How did the ruptured duck pen get its name? The abbreviated backstory, according to the American War Library and other resources, is following World War I, the idea of universal honorable discharge emblem surfaced, first as a patch, and then as a lapel pin. Both allowed honorably discharged personnel to show their former military status as they applied for civilian jobs or veterans benefits. The pins continue to be the only official all-military honorable discharge emblems. They are made by official U.S. military suppliers, and though they can be worn by honorably discharged veterans of any era, they tend to be associated with World War II veterans. The emblems bear an image intended to resemble an eagle. The ruptured duck moniker or name came from an unlikely source. Hollywood actress Hedy Lamarr, born in Austria of Jewish ancestry, she married an arms manufacturer who did business with the Nazis in Germany. A brilliant scientist and designer herself, it became known that she, not her husband, had actually designed or redesigned some of the weaponry. She learned her husband planned to kill her, and with the help of Jewish underground during World War II, fled first to London in 1937, then to the United States. Here, while building her career as an American movie star, she also developed a secret communication system designed to prevent the Nazis from intercepting Allied radio transmissions. Her technology would later blossom into some of today's most ubiquitous technology, including Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, GPS, cordless phones, and cell phones, according to the Smithsonian Institute. Lamarr's escape from the Nazis, she said, began with a flight on a broken bird, meaning a rickety airplane. In Germany, she referred to it as a Segeltuch gebrochen, which refers to or translates to ruptured duck in English. The women who made the pins in America plants weren't too impressed with the artistry of the eagle. Hearing Lamarr's comment, they dubbed it the ruptured duck. They even used the term to label the packaging, following the practice of disguising the labeling so as not to tip off any enemy agents to its contents. The nickname stuck even after General George C. Marshall decided that the term ruptured was bad for morale. In 1944, he ordered the destruction of any documents and materials bearing the ruptured duck name. More than 50 years later, the real reason for banning it became declassified. The ruptured duck moniker apparently was too close to the code name Duck Pin, which was used for General D. Eisenhower. Zayas said the Department of Georgia Purple Heart organization received a batch of the ruptured duck pins from another veterans organization. Zayas then purchased 50 pins, taking them to the nursing homes where veterans lived and pinning them on the veterans himself as it became a personal crusade. I started researching and found 162 veterans homes in the U.S., Zayas said. He's contacted 145 thus far. I kept buying pins and I've sent 1,600 of them. I'll keep going on until the last 17 are done. And so he continues on, and as he moves forward, he continues to hand these out and to honor World War II veterans. And as he moves forward, he's going to be coming here to the Northern California Veterans Home, and he'll be handing those pins out to our remaining World War II veterans here in our own community. And so we are literally coming up on the final chapter of our World War II veterans and their service to our nation, the greatest generation born out of the depression of the United States through the 20s and the 30s, who fought the nation, the battles against the world tyranny from the Imperial Japanese through the Nazi regime, Hitler, and all those, along with those who put together the internment camps and the prisoner of war camps, in the Jewish concentration camps, and to annihilate that Nazi threat and to take it out and to put it to sunder. And as we continue to honor these men and women, and as we lose them in the final generation here, we continue to move forward to our Korean War veterans and to honor our Vietnam veterans and then those of the post 9/11. We say thanks to these men and women who serve our nation in every opportunity that we have. You're listening to Battlefield Expressions. We'll be right back.
KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at kcnr1460.com. Join Sue McClain weekday mornings from 6 to 7 for the Sue McClain News Hour, where you'll hear the up-to-the-minute local news, national and international news, weather, sports, and a whole lot more. Followed by Free Fire Radio from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. with Carl and Linda Bott. From 9 to noon, be informed and laugh along with Armstrong and Getty, equal opportunity critics. From noon to 3, learn how to get out of debt with Dave Ramsey. From 3 to 6, don't miss constitutional expert Mark Levin. Monday through Thursday night, starting at 6 p.m., we have local shows featuring everything from the paranormal, local history, North State Now, and unsung heroes of our area. From 7 to 9, tune in to Ben Shapiro, your local downtown radio station, KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at kcnr1460.com.
Founded in 1995, GI Pathology is the only physician-owned laboratory in the United States dedicated solely to the practice of gastrointestinal and liver pathology. The company provides the highest quality GI pathology diagnosis made exclusively by one of our fellowship-trained gastrointestinal and liver pathologists. GI Pathology delivers results to its Northern California client base within an industry-leading 24 hours. Call 888-2-GI-PATH or go to www.gipath.com for more information.
Memory Lane Antiques and Vintage is having a grand opening Saturday, February 26th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at their new location in the Shasta Gateway Center at 1773 Highway 273 in Anderson. They will be featuring new and existing vendors, along with a variety of collectibles from around the world, with jewelry, Tiffany lamps, antique desks and dressers, and much more. Free drawings throughout the day. Memory Lane Antiques and Vintage grand opening Saturday, February 26th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at their new location in the Shasta Gateway Center, 1773 Highway 273, Anderson.
Hi, my name's Nick Gardner. I have a show here on KCNR, Sunday mornings from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. every other Sunday. The name of my show is Poke the Hornet's Nest.
There's no mountain I can't climb. There's no tower too high. No plane that I can't learn how to fly. What do I gotta do to get through to you to show you there ain't nothing I can't take this chainsaw to?
I'm going to concentrate on local politics mainly, but we'll talk about national politics also. You'll get the view of the common citizen here in Redding, California. And remember, today is the first day of the rest of your life. Maybe it's a good time for a new perspective about what's been going on in our town, in our state, in our nation. I hope you tune in and hear the other side of the news.
This is Carl Bott
and Ted Leidy.
We want to invite you to our new show, Man Up, the fourth Thursday of each month, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM.
Man Up, 6 to 7 p.m., where we explore the lost art of being a man.
Spirits, cigars, and hit the ground running when you get up in the morning. That's what Man Up's going to be about.
Oh, don't forget motorcycles, guns, and hard work every day.
And those things that men talk about when women aren't around.
That's right. Even cooking sometimes.
Even cooking sometimes. People, places, and things.
Serving your family, your community, and your country.
Man Up. Fourth Thursday of each month from 6 to 7 p.m. right here on Free Fire Radio.
to fly and fight. Who have served their country in the sky with a grateful heart and watchful eye. We remember and may the faithful proud machines who bore the sword of freedom on be given the honor such a burden brings.
Good morning. You're listening to Battlefield Expressions, and we are remembering this morning our World War II pilots, our Korean War pilots, and our guest this morning is Pat McAleer, who is a Vietnam veteran. He served as a second-class petty officer gunner's mate during the Vietnam War. And good morning, Pat. I just want to say thank you for being here this morning.
Good morning, Rob. Thanks for the invitation.
We are going to talk about your father, who was a World War II pilot and also Korean War pilot and flew for the United States Marine Corps. Captain Edward Potter McAleer, United States Marine Corps Reserve, lived from 1922 to 1988 and served the Marine Corps from 1941 to 1952. And so this morning we'll also be talking about your career in the Navy during the Vietnam War and the Tet Offensive in that time frame and your support with the destroyer that you served on. But we want to talk about your father first thing this morning. We're going to we've got about 4 minutes before we step up to our first break. But we want to be able to talk about the influence of your father's service to this nation and how it influenced you as you went on and served during the Vietnam War.
Yeah, my dad was a very interesting man in a lot of respects, and in a lot of respects, very much like thousands of other young men after the war broke out in December of 1941. At the time the war broke out in December of 1941, after the attack by the Empire of Japan on Pearl Harbor, he was in his first year of college at Bakersfield College, and he, like many, many men of his age, and he was, I think, 20 at the time, he immediately went down and signed up to join the United States Navy. In March of 1942. At that time, the government had a civilian pilot training program that was associated with most of the colleges, and Bakersfield Junior College had a similar program up in Lone Pine, California. It was called the Civilian Pilot Training Program, or CPT. He applied for it and was accepted. But he went in as a seaman in the United States Navy, and of course, if he had not matriculated through the pilot program, he would have ended up, as I did, on a destroyer somewhere later. But he successfully graduated from this civilian pilot training program and went on to additional training. It was a long, arduous process to become, ultimately, a fighter pilot, flying the F4U-1 Corsairs. The second phase of that program was pre-flight training, and they wanted to send him back for additional training under the civilian pilot program, but he wrote a letter to the War Department and asked to skip that and go straight into pre-flight training, because this was right after the Battle of Midway, where the Japanese lost four of their carriers, and I think my dad was worried he wasn't going to get into the fight.
The war was going to end, and he never got a chance to have any combat duty.
Exactly. So he wrote a letter, and much to his surprise, they wrote him back and said, "Fine, you want to graduate early? We'll send you to pre-flight."
That's amazing that they allowed him to do that. But they needed pilots so bad.
They needed pilots. And when I was reviewing his records, I found that copy of that letter. And later on, he had scribbled this note on it. He said, "God, I was crazy. They even listened to my plea and sent me up to the front."
Be careful what you ask for. You just might get it.
Exactly. He went to pre-flight training at St. Mary's here in California, and eventually successfully graduated from that. That was mostly academics, and he was worried that he might not pass the mathematics part of it, but he eventually did, and he took the next step. The next step was primary flight training, and that was at Los Alamos, and this was he went there, he had 40 hours of civilian flight time at the time he got there, and that's when he started flying a different type of airplane. After graduating from pre-flight, he went to Naval Aviation Training at Corpus Christi, Texas.
Hold that thought, Pat. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Battlefield Expressions. Our guest this morning, Pat McAleer, and we're discussing his World War II father flying the F-4U Corsair.
Hi, this is Matt with Liberty Unabashed, a show on every other Sunday at 8 in the morning. Come check out my music and the deep thought and let me shatter your paradigm.
Let's keep it 100. Them traitors think they won, but them patriots coming. You fall for anything if you don't stand for something. Some people say it's time to fight, but it ain't about nothing, yeah. And I only about it, God can't about it, nothing else. Yeah, it's time to fight. And it don't matter if you're black or white. And I know it's gonna take some sacrifice.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wayne Carpenter and Terry Raposa. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archives link.
ACA, come out and play. Have you seen the bill? We all have to pay. The time has come for 51 in a Jefferson State of Mind.
Hey friends, this is RC with Tobacco and Brew. Today we're talking about the Fugly from Tabacalera El Artista. Coming in a 5x40 Vitola, the Fugly is priced just right for our value-conscious customers. Draped in a chocolatey brown San Andres leaf, presented in natural or Maduro, this stick is a throwback to a Cheroot vintage. The Fugly from Tabacalera El Artista, Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
Hi, this is Dr. Patricia Bay, and my radio show, Therapy in a Nutshell, which airs on Saturdays at 11 a.m. on KCNR, 1460 a.m., or 96.5 FM, is a great show for you to listen to and learn how to effectively change your life. We talk about issues such as communication and trust, couples issues, and many more. Also, you can listen to the radio show on my podcast through the Anchor app, which is free and safe. Or you can tune into the iTunes or Spotify podcast and listen to it there. It's a nice show that'll help you throughout the day and throughout your life. So join me for Therapy in a Nutshell, Saturdays, 11 a.m. at KCNR Radio. This is Dr. Patricia Bay, trying to heal the world 1 hour at a time.
You get me every time.
Shasta County, are you ready for something real special? Mary's Pizza Shack has some changes. We're now Charlie's Tap House, and a tap house rule number one is come in for the homemade pizzas, pastas, and other house-made specialties, and stay for the beer wall.
Mary's Pizza Shack is now Charlie's Tap House, pizza, pasta, grill. Same family owners and same homemade recipes. Plus, a few more you'll want to try for yourself. Friday nights, try our special hand-cut prime rib for just $28 with all the fixings. And all week, you can enjoy surf and turf or salmon and polenta.
Don't miss Shasta County's premier tap beer wall with your favorite beers on demand that you can order by the ounce. Try our new house beer collaboration with Woody's Brewing, Flippin' Hazy. Your taste buds will thank you. And when you sign up for our Tap House Rewards program, you'll automatically get $5 off towards your next order. Remember, our vibe is casual. The atmosphere is social.
Order online at charlews.com. That's charlews.com.
I walked through a county courthouse square. On a park bench, an old man was sitting there. I said, "Your old courthouse is kind of run down." He said, "No, it'll do for our little town." I said, "Your old flagpole has leaned a little bit, and that's a ragged old flag you got hanging on it." He said, "Have a seat," and I sat down. "Is this the first time you've been to our little town?" I said, "I think it is." He said, "I don't like to brag, but we're kind of proud of that ragged old flag. You see, we got a little hole in that flag there when Washington took it across the Delaware. And it got powder burned the night that Francis Scott Key sat watching it write and say, 'Can you see?' And it got a bad rip in New Orleans with Pakenham and Jackson tugging at its seams. And it almost fell at the Alamo beside the Texas flag, but she waved on, though. She got cut with a sword at Chancellorsville, and she got cut again at Shiloh Hill. There was Robert E. Lee, Beauregard, and Bragg, and the south wind blew hard on that ragged old flag. On Flanders Field in World War I, she got a big hole from a Bertha gun. She turned blood red in World War II. She hung limp and low a time or two. She was in Korea, Vietnam. She went where she was sent by her Uncle Sam. She waved from our ships upon the briny foam, and now they've about quit waving back here at home. In her own good land here, she's been abused. She's been burned, dishonored, denied, and refused. And the government for which she stands is scandalized throughout the land. And she's getting threadbare and she's wearing thin, but she's in good shape for the shape she's in. Cause she's been through the fire before. And I believe she can take a whole lot more. So we raise her up every morning. We take her down every night. We don't let her touch the ground and we fold her upright. On second thought, I do like to brag. Cause I'm mighty proud of that ragged old flag.
Good morning, you're listening to Battlefield Expressions. Johnny Cash, Ragged Old Flag. And every one of us who have served this nation, we served for that ragged old flag and to make sure that we keep the freedom and the preservation of our freedom across our country. This morning, as we're talking about our freedom preservation, we're talking about a World War II pilot who served also during the Korean War, Captain Edward Potter McAleer, United States Marine Corps Reserve, and flew and served the United States Marine Corps from 1941 to 1952. His son is here this morning, Pat McAleer, who served also as a gunner's mate, United States Navy, during the Vietnam War. And, Pat, thank you for being here this morning and for being able to share the story about your father. And then also we'll be talking a little bit later about your service during the Vietnam era.
Well, thanks, Rob. It's a great opportunity. There's nothing I like more than talking about my dad. He was quite a guy. And I think where we left off, he had successfully graduated from pre-flight training, and then his next step was Corpus Christi, Texas. He was in Corpus Christi from February of 1943 to July of 1943. This is where they introduced hopeful pilots to all sorts of different types of aircraft, including the aviation cadets were trained to fly specific types of mission aircraft, including dive bombers, multi-engine bombers like B-25s and large PBYs, flying boats, and single-seat fighters. As you might well imagine, almost all those young men wanted to become a single-seat fighter pilot.
Right.
And my dad was no exception to that. He made that very clear in his notes. He worked really hard to get into a single-seat fighter. At that point in their training, the only choice they had was to either become Navy pilots or Marine Corps pilots. My dad wanted to become a Marine Corps pilot because the Marines didn't fly multi-engine airplanes very often, so he thought it was a better chance to get into a single-seat fighter. And he didn't know what those were. At the outbreak of the war, the American armed forces were woefully inadequate to take on both the Germans and the Japanese at the same time. The Japanese had much better airplanes than we did. At the outbreak of the war, the airplane that was the Marine Corps was flying was a Brewster Buffalo, which was state of the art when it was designed in the mid 30s, but by the beginning of the war, it was obsolete. In fact, the last squadron, I think it was VMF 221, yeah, the Fighting Falcons. They were flying the Buffaloes on Midway when Midway was attacked, and by the end of the first day, there was only one of those planes that was capable of flying.
The attack on Pearl Harbor, when they sunk the ships and they went ahead and destroyed the aviation across the South Pacific, it really launched the United States into a new era of aviation and of shipbuilding. And so all the new technology was designed for a quick attack against the enemy, whether it was in the Atlantic or the Pacific. Otherwise, we'd have still been using World War I era ships and aircraft and equipment to fight the war. And by all that, most of that being destroyed at the very beginning, forced us into building a new era of technology, which helped to win the war.
Well, that's very true. In fact, Yamamoto, who was the architect of the attack on Pearl Harbor, knew that for a fact, that it was going to have to be a quick war. He knew, having trained and gone to Harvard, I believe.
Yes.
He knew that the size of America's industrial might would catch up with them fairly quickly. In any event, getting back to the training program, by the time my father got his flight wings, the Americans had developed several new types of aircraft. And fortunately, when my dad eventually ended up going into combat, he was flying the F-4U, which was a airplane far superior to the Japanese Zero, which they started with in 1941. It took him a while to get those flight wings, though, and he finished up at Corpus Christi. He was actually flying an SNJ, or the Army version, which was called the Texas A-6. This was a very powerful training program. It had a Pratt & Whitney 1,340 horsepower engine with a retractable landing gears. It had a climbing rate of 1,200 feet per second, and it was equipped with 30 caliber machine guns. So this was the first real airplane he got to fly, and that was part of training. After he graduated from Corpus Christi, he was sent to Florida for advanced fighter training, and he was there from July of 1943 to September of 1943. He started off flying the SNJ and then graduated to the Brewster Buffalo, which was the airplane that had become obsolete, but it was still the first real fighter plane that he got to fly. Let me see. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Corsair and the development. They started developing the Corsair in 1939, and it was ordered by the Navy, United States Navy, and was intended to be a carrier airplane, flying from the aircraft carriers. But when they turned over the Corsair to the Navy in 1942, and they initially deployed it to carrier duty, but they found it to be a very real disappointment. The nature of the Corsair, it had a really, really long nose on it, and it had it was very difficult to land those on a carrier. My dad eventually did qualify in between the World War II and the Korean War. He was required to requalify on carriers, but he never liked flying off of a carrier. So,
well, especially as a Marine Corps pilot, I mean, everything they do is on long runways.
Yes.
Even if they're steel matting in the South Pacific.
Yeah. The British actually developed a way of landing those planes on carriers, and eventually the Navy did too, towards the end of the war. But that's how my dad, who started off as a Navy pilot, eventually became a Marine Corps pilot, because they gave the Corsair, the Navy gave the Corsair to the Marine Corps. Because the Marines weren't taking off of carriers and landing on carriers. And it worked really well, considering the strategy Chester Nimitz developed in the South Pacific against the Japanese, the island hopping. So they would move from island to island, and one of the first really successful squadrons was 221, which James Sweat was, I think.
Yes, correct. He was a second lieutenant when he was attached to them at Henderson Field in Guadalcanal.
In Guadalcanal.
We're going to talk a little bit more about that. You're listening to Battlefield Expressions, and we'll be right back.
The Sikh Cultural Education Center and SCAR, in partnership with Shasta Lake Chiropractic in the city of Shasta Lake, are having a free COVID-19 vaccination clinic Friday, February 18th, from 1:30 p.m. until 6:30 p.m. at Shasta Lake Chiropractic at 4221 Shasta Dam Boulevard. All COVID-19 vaccines, including Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson, will be available, including boosters. No appointment needed. California's indoor mask requirement is ending this month for those who've been vaccinated, and all Shasta County residents ages 5 and up are now eligible to receive the vaccine. Kids 5 to 11 and youths 12 to 17 must be accompanied by parents or guardians for consent. Come in and get vaccinated at this free clinic in the city of Shasta Lake and enjoy free food while organizers hand out gift cards to vaccine recipients. Multilingual translators will also be available at this free clinic at Shasta Lake Chiropractic at 4221 Shasta Dam Boulevard, Friday, February 18th from 1:30 p.m. until 6:30 p.m.
Hi, this is Senior Chief Rob Burrows with the Northern California Veterans Museum and Heritage Center, and I am your host every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 with Battlefield Expressions. Battlefield Expressions is where we talk about veterans issues, advocacy for our community, and those in our community who help support our veterans. Once again, join me every Saturday morning from 9 to 11, Battlefield Expressions on KCNR 96.5 at 1460 AM.
This is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home, too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
Hi, this is Linda Bott. Join me for my show, North State Now, on the first Thursday of every month. We'll cover what's going on in the North State, Axiom Theater, local theater, arts, food, film, and even the latest in astrology. That's North State Now on the first Thursday of the month at 6 p.m. on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. Also streaming on KCNR1460.com.
Came home to Tennessee, a young man at the end of 45. Only one of seven men in his platoon that made it back alive. He must have seen some tough times, but he never talked too much about all that. Put his pictures and his memories in the cedar chest. Everything but his old army hat. By the time I graduated, the winds of change had blown across our land. They were burning flags and draft cards when they bothered to take some kind of stand. And we used to laugh at Grandpa like he was some old relic from the past. 'Cause he never left the house unless he was wearing that funny-looking, worn-out army hat. Every eye was on him anytime that he went anywhere. They whispered and they pointed, but you could tell that Grandpa didn't care. A whole lot more than that. For my buddy. everything, the least that I can do is keep on wearing this old army hat. He called me up one morning, said he'd seen it on the news on his TV. They've opened up a monument to World War II in Washington, D.C. I ain't getting any younger, and I wish someone would take me to see that. I couldn't help but think they're gonna laugh at you up there if you show up in that silly army hat. Two strangers both saluted as Grandpa walked up to the monument. One said, "Thank you, soldier, for a job well done." The other said, "Amen." And a young boy said, "Sir, my daddy went to war and never made it back. Would you take a picture standing here beside me and maybe let me wear your army hat?" Every eye was on him, and there was not a dry one in the crowd. They whispered and they pointed, and Grandpa stood up extra tall and proud. He said, "Son, just keep it," when the young boy tried his best to give it back. "You're a brave little soldier, son, and every soldier needs his very own authentic army hat. For your daddy who gave everything, the least that I can do is pass on this old worn out army hat."
Good morning, you're listening to Battlefield Expressions, and that is the World War II Memorial there in Washington, D.C. On our flight, Northern California, we did 26 flights back to Washington, D.C., taking back right around 1,000 World War II veterans to see that memorial. Honor, privilege to be around those men and women who served this nation during the World War II, and to be there to see them, see and understand and appreciate the fact that there was a monument, and the people that did step up and shake their hands, and those that were in wheelchairs to help push them around. Children would come up and talk to them. It was life-changing, life-moving. To be there and to witness that and to be a part of that. Tom and Debbie Johnson on a flight in Northern California. And like I said, 26 flights, 26 missions back there, taking care of all of those World War II veterans for a five-day period, coming and going from coast to coast. And this morning, once again, we're talking about a Korean War World War II veteran. Our guest this morning is Pat McAleer, Vietnam veteran. We're talking about his father, Captain Edward Potter McAleer, United States Marine Corps, served during World War II and the Korean War as an F-4U fighter pilot. Good morning again, Pat, as we talk about your dad and his service to our nation.
Yeah. Well, we were talking about the Corsair as an airplane. My dad, of course, was still training as a pilot when the Corsair was turned over to the Navy in 1942. They had all sorts of problems with it because of the long nose on this airplane. They had difficulty landing them on carriers. It had a undercarriage that was somewhat weakened. So the Navy in 1943 elected to go with the F-6 Hellcat as their carrier plane, which was an improved version of the Wildcat. The Corsair they gave to the Marine Corps. My dad used to like to say the Marine Corps is part of the Navy, but my dad used to say the Navy gave them all the garbage stuff, except for the Corsair. It turned out to be an excellent flying platform for the Marine Corps, which was flying them off of land-based airstrips in the South Pacific. It was a very difficult airplane to learn how to fly, and it was very complicated airplane. When they decided to give it to the Marine Corps, my dad, who was a Navy pilot, all of a sudden became a Marine Corps pilot, which is what he wanted in the first place. So he was very happy about that. They sent him to, from Florida, he went to Santa Barbara, where he was assigned to a very storied squadron, VMF 212, transitioning from the Brewster Buffalo to the Corsair. And that's when he learned how to fly the Corsair airplane. He would take that plane. He was from Bakersfield, and he was in Santa Barbara learning how to fly the Corsair. And so he would take that airplane and fly it home over to Bakersfield. Can you imagine being 21 years old and flying a Corsair?
About 45 minutes.
Yeah.
45-minute flight right over the hills there.
He would buzz his mother's house in Bakersfield. But I'd like to read you what he said about learning how to fly the Corsair, and these are in his own words. He left notes that I was able to find after he passed away. So these are in his own words. He said, "When you climb into the seat of a F4U-1A as it's set on the runway in a three-point position with the parachute under you, and you came upon you a frightening, almost overwhelming sensation. You couldn't see a damn thing except 12 feet of aluminum in front of you. Then you would crank up the monstrous R2800 Pratt & Whitney and swear to God, if you ever managed to get this monster off the ground and back again in one piece, you would never try it a second time. And some didn't. Usually pried one out, and so it did with me. My log shows that on December 4th, 1943, the moment of truth was realized. When the pilots refer to God as my co-pilot, this is no exaggeration. Someone had to have been in that cockpit with me on December 4th, 1943 during that flight. I was too damn scared to have flown that bird by myself." And in the early F4Us, you truly felt like you were sitting in a well. Absolutely no forward visibility at all on the ground. The plane captain gives you the thumbs up. You turn the switch. You check your mixture controls. Check your RPMs and say a Hail Mary. Push that starter and hope like hell it won't start. The plane captain removes the chocks, leads you to the line, and buddy, you are on your own. The only way to feel your way out to the runway is by making a series of 30 degrees left and 30 degrees right. You stagger out. Unfortunately, the F4U also had bad brakes. We were continually told to stay off the brakes, and we tried. However, sometimes they came in handy when you were touching down and you found yourself heading off the runway towards your CO's Jeep. Anyway, by turning side to side, if by remarkable coincidence you found yourself in the takeoff point, you had better be absolutely certain you are in line with the runway, because once you start to roll, you never again see where you're headed until your nose down and the tail's up. On occasion, if not perfectly lined up, you would get to the tail up and the nose down only to find yourself heading towards the tower. This is where the brake came in handy. Your first landing invariably caused you to wonder if bailing out was more prudent than trying to make a blind landing. Blind for two reasons. There was the long nose and oil which accumulated on the windscreen during the course of your flight. The early birds had lots of oil leaks, all of which made the use of the aircraft carrier difficult. Yeah, if you look at pictures of those early Corsairs, you'll see all those white strips out in front of the cockpit.
The streaks, yeah.
And what that was tape that they used to cover all the seams so the oil wouldn't fly up on the windscreen.
Well, then you wonder, you know, you always look and those guys are always wearing the goggles. Well, the goggles just weren't there to keep the bugs out.
Right.
They were to keep the oil out of
your
eyes.
The news from Town Hall.
Yep.
So we're going to get ready to go to a break here, and we'll come right back. You're listening to Battlefield Expressions.
KCNR, Shasta, Reading.
Breaking news this hour at townhall.com. I'm Bob Agnew with Washington. Last-minute diplomatic calls taking place today between the U.S. and Russia over Ukraine.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov spoke by telephone to attempt to ease tensions. Lavrov apparently told Blinken that the U.S. and its allies are pursuing a propaganda campaign about Russian aggression, he called provocative. Russia has amassed well over 100,000 troops near the Ukraine border. Before their phone meeting, Blinken told the press,
"We continue to see very troubling signs of Russian escalation, including new forces arriving around Ukraine's border."
He also warned of the consequences if an invasion of Ukraine occurred.
"We will swiftly impose severe economic sanctions in coordination with allies and partners around the globe. Will bolster Ukraine's ability to defend itself."
Russian President Vladimir Putin and President Joe Biden are to hold a high-stakes telephone call as the rhetoric continues to escalate around the Ukraine crisis. I'm Karen Chamas.
Police have moved in to remove protesters at the busiest U.S.-Canadian border crossing. Many of them had spent the night at the busiest crossing between Detroit and Windsor, Ontario, before they started singing their Canadian national anthem. It was a blockade that's disrupted the flow of traffic and goods and forced the auto industry on both sides of the border to temporarily roll back production. The U.S. has added another gold medal to its count at the Winter Games in Beijing.
The United States strikes gold in the first ever mixed team snowboard cross finals. 40-year-old Nick Baumgartner of Iron River, Michigan, earned his first career medal in his fourth trip to the Olympics. 36-year-old Lindsay Jacob Ellis picked up her second gold medal at the Beijing Games and her third career podium in five separate Olympic journeys.
And that report from Denny Kapp on Wall Street Friday. The Dow lost more than 500 points. More from Town Hall.
So I invested in one of those fancy new exercise bikes. Without a doubt, a very special tool to help me get healthier. The problem is 3 days go by, then four, and I've done nothing. And then it's night five, and I'm sitting at the kitchen table, and I look down at myself, and I can't help but just laugh. Because there I am, wearing the exercise t-shirt that came with the bike, and I'm eating two corn dogs. I think we'd all agree, the special tool only matters if we use it to our benefit. At United Faith Mortgage, we believe we have an advantageous tool for you. Our mortgage team is an arm of a bigger company who is a direct lender, which means our company gets to use its own money and make its own decisions. There's no middleman. And often, this allows us to get you a better rate on your refinance or new home purchase, which can save you monthly and lifelong money. We or United Faith Mortgage.
United Faith Mortgage is a DBA of United Mortgage Corp, 25 Middle Park Road, Melville, New York. Licensed mortgage banker. For all licensing information, go to animalistconsumeraccess.org. Corporate animalist number 1330. Equal housing lender. Other license in Alaska, Hawaii, Georgia, Massachusetts, North Dakota, South Dakota, or Utah.
President Biden says America's best days are ahead. A new poll shows many Americans would beg to differ.
The sense of turmoil was captured in a new CNN SSRS poll released Thursday that showed waning faith in U.S. elections and found that most of the nearly 60% of Americans who disapprove of how Mr. Biden is handling his presidency were unable to name one single thing they liked about what he's done. One despondent respondent said, "He's not Donald Trump, that's pretty much it." According to CNN's new poll, 37% of Americans say Mr. Biden did not legitimately win enough votes to be president. Bernie Bennett reporting.
A Florida House bill is seeking to remove lessons about gender identity and race from public schools that make students feel discomfort. The House bill, along with its companion Senate bill, is part of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis' Stop Woke Act. Florida's Individual Freedoms Bill removes the word gender from statutory language. Breaking news and analysis at townhall.com. Tax receipts from surging gun and ammunition sales have boosted money for a U.S. conservation program.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says excise taxes on guns, ammunition, and archery equipment brought in $1.1 billion to be doled out in state grants in 2022 for wildlife conservation and hunter education.
And that report from correspondent Keith Peters. Meanwhile, we've got another report of an unruly air passenger.
A Virginia man faces time in prison after pleading guilty to interfering with the crew on a United Airlines flight last year. 29-year-old Cameron Stone of Fairfax, Virginia, tried to open the cockpit door and struck a flight attendant who tried to stop him. The flight attendant suffering bruising on her chest, face, arm, and shoulder. Three other passengers restrained the man, and that's when three mini bottles of vodka fell out of his pocket.
That is John Scott reporting. More on these stories at townhall.com.
The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
It was during the Vietnam conflict. A bunch of soldiers had been on a long hike. And they arrived in a town called Saigon. And the next day, being Sunday, several of the boys went to church. After the chaplain read the prayer, the text was taken up. Those of the boys who had prayer books took them out. But one boy had only a deck of cards, so he spread them out. The sergeant in charge of the boys saw the cards and said, "Soldier, put away those cards." And after the service was over, the soldier was taken prisoner and brought before the provost marshal. The marshal said, "Sergeant, why have you brought this man here?" "For playing cards in church, sir." "And what have you to say for yourself, son?" "Much, sir," the soldier replied. The marshal said, "I hope so, for if not, I shall punish you severely." "You see, sir, I've been on the march for 6 days, and I had neither Bible nor prayer book. But I hope to satisfy you, sir, with the purity of my intentions. You see, sir, when I look at the ace, it reminds me there is but one God. And when I see the deuce, it reminds me that the Bible is divided into two parts, the Old and the New Testaments. And when I see the tray, I think of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. And when I see the four, I think of the four evangelists who preached the gospel. They were Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And when I see the five, it reminds me of the five wise virgins who trimmed their lamps. There was 10 of them. Five were wise and were saved. Five were foolish and were shut out. And when I see the six, it reminds me that in 6 days God made this great heaven and earth. And when I see the seven, it reminds me that on the seventh day, God rested. And when I see the eight, I think of the eight righteous persons God saved when he destroyed this earth. There was Noah, his wife, and their three sons, and their wives. And when I see the nine, I think of the lepers our Savior cleansed. And nine of the ten didn't even thank him. And when I see the king, it reminds me once again, there is but one King of heaven, God Almighty. And when I see the queen, I think of the Blessed Virgin Mary, who is Queen of Heaven, and the jack or knave is the devil. And when I count the number of spots on a deck of cards, I find 365, the number of days in a year. There are 52 cards, the number of weeks in a year. There are 13 tricks, the number of weeks in a quarter. And there are 4 suits, the number of weeks in a month. There's 12 picture cards, the number of months in a year. So you see, sir, my deck of cards served me as a Bible, almanac, and prayer book. And friends, this story is true because my son was that soldier.
Good morning. You're listening to Battlefield Expressions. And I always listen to that song and think of what a who would have ever thought of that? But when you're out by yourself and you're believe me, when you're bivouacked and you're out in the middle of nowhere, and there's all different kinds of things that go through your mind, and that's one of the ways that somebody developed the ingenuity of using a deck of cards as a reference to the Bible. What an interesting concept. This morning you're listening to Battlefield Expressions. Again, our guest this morning is Pat McAleer, Vietnam veteran, gunner's mate, second class petty officer. And we are talking about his father, who was a World War II and Korean War fighter pilot in the F4U Corsair. Talking about the capability of the aircraft and his father's service and what took place as they were flying. And one of the things we're discussing is that in Korea, the Marines tried to get the Navy pilots to fly coverage to come in and do low-level flying. But the Navy pilots were not trained that way because they were carrier pilots. They didn't come in that way. But the flying the F4U Corsair, You have to get low, you have to get level, you have to get straight on the runway, and then you touch down. And so when they're flying the F-4U Corsair as cover, these cover pilots, these Marine Corps pilots were flying cover at 200 to 300 feet right above the deck of the trees. Two reasons. Number one, they can get down close and dirty and kill the enemy. And number two is that the higher you are, the greater the target. And so these aircraft, like we had talked about earlier, would do 300 to 400 knots. They were screaming along. They were on top. The Marines loved them because when they came in, they knew that those Marine Corps pilots were not going to pull up too soon. They were going to be right on the target and help take out that enemy target, whether it was bombs, whether it was machine gun fire, or it was napalm, whatever, rockets, whatever it was. And they could depend on their fellow Marine Corps pilots to help save their lives in those situations.
Yeah, Rob, that's absolutely true. In fact, in my dad's scrapbook, he had an envelope with a palm leaf in there that he had pulled out from underneath the oil cooler on his Corsair. He came that close to the trees.
That is low and dirty.
That's low and dirty. And that's what he did. He was transferred from Santa Barbara to the Marshall Islands. The Marine Corps had conquered Kwajalein in December of 1943, and the squadron he was assigned to was VMF 441, the Blackjacks. He arrived there in March of 1944 and flew combat missions against a number of Japanese islands between March of 1944 and April of 1945. By the time he got there, the Americans had vanquished the Japanese airplanes. My dad never saw a Japanese airplane in the air. There were a lot of them wrecked, but he did not actually fly against the Japanese planes. What they were doing was what you described earlier. They were bombing and strafing the Japanese islands that had been bypassed by the American forces. So he was there in 1944 and in 1945. During the 11 months he was there, He flew 192 combat missions. He was awarded the DFC twice and had seven air medals.
The Distinguished Flying Cross.
Yes, the Distinguished Flying Cross. But what they did, well, I'll just read one of the citations. For meritorious achievement in aerial flight as a pilot of a fighter plane in the Marine Fighter Squadron VMF 441, in action against the enemy Japanese forces in the Marshall Islands from March to November 1944, carried out repeated low-level strafing runs on Woji Island. 20 May, First Lieutenant McAleer set fire to an enemy oil storage dump and silenced anti-aircraft guns. On June 24th, he again assisted in strikes on enemy aircraft guns on Woji Island, and hostile fire was endangering planes that were searching for a downed pilot. He scored a direct hit on a heavy dual-purpose anti-aircraft gun on several islands, dropped his bombs in the assigned area despite concentrated enemy aircraft fire, damaging four planes and wounding two pilots. His courage and devotion to duty throughout were in keeping with the highest tradition of the United States Marine Corps Services. He was rotated back to the United States in March of 1944, just prior to the squadron being relocated to Yantan Field in Okinawa, where they lost a lot of pilots with the kamikazes. So in a lot of respects, he was probably quite fortunate to get rotated back at that time. From there, he ended the war. He stayed in the reserves in the Bay Area and was flying on weekends to maintain his reserve status and, of course, for the extra money. By then, he had married my mother and had two children. He was in law school when the Korean War broke out. I mentioned this to you earlier. He came came home to my mother, and my mother was sitting there on the couch reading a letter from the Marine Corps, and asked him, said, Ed, where is Korea? So that's when he ended up being, because he was in the reserves, he immediately went to Korea, whereas the pilots that did not stay in the reserves had a period of training to do before they went. But my dad was fully qualified at that point.
We're going to take a quick break. Your father has just received his letter for to be deployed to Korea. And we'll come back. We'll talk more about his service in Korea with the United States Marine Corps as a F4U Corsair pilot. You're listening to Battlefield Expressions. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home, too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
Now is a great time to prepare for this year's upcoming wildfire season. Reading Electric Utility and City of Reading staff are busy clearing vegetation to mitigate wildfire risk to our facilities and to the community. You can also prepare by trimming back shrubs and tree branches that are closer than 5 feet from your home, clear debris from your roof and gutters, and clear dead vegetation on your property. For information about tree trimming and proximity of power lines, call 530-224-4356. We all need to work together to prevent wildfires in our community.
We're here with Mortgage Matt from Megastar Financial here in Reading. Matt, what if someone has just recently purchased a home or recently financed, like a year ago?
You know, this last year has been insane. A lot of people with the work from home phenomena, there's a lot of people moving here from metropolitan areas, which has, you know, affected the supply and demand of this market. That has really boosted the value of houses. So right now, people are looking to remodel their home or consolidate debt. They're able to do that at a lower cost with a cash out refinance than they ever have in history.
Talk about the value of using a local mortgage company, and why Megastar Financial?
The nice thing about us being local is our accessibility. You mean people can meet with us in a safe way, but whatever people are comfortable with. We can do an application process online on our website, or we can do an application together over the phone.
Megastar Financial, America's most trusted mortgage company, located at 920 Hilltop Drive next door to Chuck E. Cheese. Call 999-9000 or get started online at megastarreading.com. NMLS 1162668.
Each year, millions of older adults suffer injuries from a fall. One out of five falls results in serious injuries such as broken bone, head injuries, or death. Many falls are preventable. PSA 2 Area Agency on Aging announces the Dignity at Home Fall Prevention Program, funded by the California Department of Aging. This no-cost program's mission is to reduce the number of debilitating falls suffered at home by older adults and persons with disabilities. If you are 60 and older, or persons with disabilities of any age that meet the income criteria, and are at risk of falling or being institutionalized, this program may be able to help. The Dignity at Home Fall Prevention Program was established for the purpose of reducing the number of debilitating falls suffered by older adults and persons with disabilities, thus enabling older adults and persons with disabilities to live independently and safely in their home environment for as long as possible. Contact PSA 2 Area Agency on Aging at 842-1687. That's 842-1687 to find out how this no-cost program may help.
Hello, I'm Chris Christopherson. On November 8, 1965, the 173rd Airborne Brigade on Operation Hump, War Zone D in Vietnam, were ambushed by over 1,200 VC. 48 American soldiers lost their lives. Severely wounded and risking his own life, Lawrence Joel, a medic, was the first living black man since the Spanish-American War to receive the United States Medal of Honor for saving so many lives in the midst of battle that day. Our friend Niles Harris, retired 25 years United States Army, the guy who gave Big Kenny his top hat, was one of the wounded who lived. This song is his story. Caught in the action of kill or be killed, greater love hath no man than to lay down his life for his brother.
Listening to Battlefield Expressions, the 8th of November, remembering our Vietnam veterans who served and gave their lives and sacrificed. And also as we come back, we're remembering and we're talking about Eddie McAleer, who was United States Marine Corps Captain, Marine Corps Reserve, served during World War II and during Korea. And we're finishing up talking about his service in Korea. And then we're going to talk with Pat, his son, about his service with the United States Navy, his destroyer service, and his time when they served during the Vietnam War and the Tet Offensive from the Navy point of view. Good morning again, Pat. Thank you for being here to share your dad's story and your story also.
Pleasure's all mine. My dad was in college in between in the Bay Area when he received notice that he was being called up for the Korean War. He was immediately transferred down to El Toro in Southern California and then shipped overseas. He arrived in Korea at the end of February 1951. By that time, they were flying a new version of the Corsair. If you ever see a Corsair with four propellers, that is a Korean War airplane. They had redesigned the propellers on it, and so he was flying the new Corsair. He flew 12 combat strikes in Korea, his last occurring in March 28th, 51. The squadron action report indicates he led a division out the attack buildings containing enemy troops and supplies. In April of 1951, he was transferred from the squadron to a forward air control squadron. Well, not a squadron. They were. He was operating a jeep. They were sent out, and he would call in the airstrikes, and that's how he finished his time in Korea. The last 6 months in Korea, but it did give him an opportunity to observe all the other types of fighter aircraft that the armed forces were using over there, including the P-51 Mustangs, P-38s, and several others, and he concluded that the Corsair was the best fighter plane that the American forces had. And he finished up his career as a captain. He was invited to stay in the Marine Corps as a major, and he declined to do so. And when he landed his last airplane in Oakland, that was the last time he flew an airplane.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I went to school with a lot of Navy pilots in San Diego, and most of those guys, you know, once they flew those airplanes, they stayed just for an opportunity to fly those planes.
Right.
My dad figured he had used up most of his nine lives by that time. He had crashed one Corsair in training, all that was left. In fact, it was a squadron commander's personal airplane. And Corsair had a terrible flaw. It had a terrible stall characteristic. So once he landed that last plane, that was it. He was done flying. So he finished up the Korean War, and he was finished.
He called it a done deal.
He lived through it.
Well, you know, and not only that, but how could you ever fly again and come close to having the exhilaration of flying that Corsair at 400 knots at 300 feet off the ground, firing machine guns, rockets, and bombs?
Yep.
There's nowhere ever. I mean, it's just, you just could never get that again in your life. And like you said, after he'd seen so much combat, it was time to take care of his wife and his kids, you.
Yeah.
You and your family, so.
That's absolutely true. I think he felt very fortunate to survive two wars flying that Corsair airplane. Yeah.
Well, that was a part of history that will never be. I mean, it was just an unbelievable time in our aviation and in the military aspect of our nation.
Yeah.
Serving around the world.
There's an interesting story involving the Corsair. In 2016, I received an email from a friend of mine whose father was in the same squadron, asking me to check my dad's logbook to see, because there was an airplane that had been restored, a Corsair in Chino, by Planes of Fame. And that airplane, it was restored to flying condition, but they didn't have the history on the airplane. And sure enough, I looked at my dad's flight log, and he had flown that same airplane for four different missions in Kwajalein in June of 1944. I gave them all the information, and they invited me down there, and I was one of the speakers at where they highlighted that particular airplane. And they took my sister, Mary Ann, who's a banker here in Redding now, and they took her for a ride in that airplane. Isn't that an amazing story?
It is, especially since it was an aircraft your father actually flew in combat missions.
Actually flew four combat missions in it. So I gave them that history and told them, yes, that airplane had actually been in combat in the Marshall Islands.
Now, we were talking earlier why that aircraft was preserved.
Yeah, it was preserved. It was purchased after the war by MGM, and they used it as a prop in a lot of the war movies that were done. Then they had a TV show called Ba Ba Black Sheep.
Right.
Pappy Boynton Squadron 214, and they restored it to flying condition, and they used it in that TV series. And the gentleman who started the Planes of Fame, acquired that airplane and restored it again to flying condition, and it's flying to this day.
Wow, it's amazing.
Yep.
Especially with a 75-year-old airframe.
Yeah. And it was an early version, too. It was like the first version. It was F4U1.
Wow. That is the very first version, yes.
Yep.
So now we've talked about your father and his influence in your life. Now we want to talk about your Navy service as we move forward. We're at our 10:30 break right now. When we come back, we're going to talk about your service and your service during the Vietnam War. You're listening to Battlefield Expressions. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Linda Bott. Join me for my show, North State Now, on the first Thursday of every month. We'll cover what's going on in the North State, Axiom Theater, local theater, art, food, film, and even the latest in astrology. That's North State Now on the first Thursday of the month at 6 p.m. on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. Also streaming on KCNR1460.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Patricia Bay, and my radio show, Therapy in a Nutshell, which airs on Saturdays at 11 a.m. on KCNR, 1460 a.m., or 96.5 FM, is a great show for you to listen to and learn how to effectively change your life. We talk about issues such as communication and trust, couples issues, and many more. Also, you can listen to the radio show on my podcast through the Anchor app, which is free and safe. Or you can tune into the iTunes or Spotify podcast and listen to it there. It's a nice show that'll help you throughout the day and throughout your life. So join me for Therapy in a Nutshell, Saturdays, 11 a.m. at KCNR Radio. This is Dr. Patricia Bay, trying to heal the world 1 hour at a time.
You get me every time.
It's a bright new day. The sun is shining, the birds are singing, and there's never been a better day to try Mount Shasta spring water. Hi, I'm Bob the Drought. I come from a protected spring at the base of Mount Shasta. I'm bottled at the source. It doesn't get more cool and refreshing than that, and it's delivered right to your door. Yep, pure and simple, naturally the best. Start your bright new day by calling 1-800-922-6227 to order some of the best tasting water on the planet, Mount Shasta spring water.
Retirement may seem to be in the distant future, or it may suddenly arrive overnight. At Stifel Investments, we are committed to working closely with our clients. Planning tomorrow means understanding the challenges of today. Uncertain markets, rising costs, and longer lifespans. As a financial advisor of 25 years, I'm committed to helping my clients achieve retirement success. Let's get started today. This is Susan Eastman, Stifel Nicholas & Company, 244-7199.
When people ask me for a recommendation for a heating or air conditioning company, I always say Alliance Heating and Air. Why? Well, they've been taking care of our HVAC system for 14 years. Professional, friendly, and willing to go to the extra step for their customers. I have found no problem too difficult or too minor for them to repair. I recommend Alliance Heating and Air with no reservations. You can reach them at 530-221-2642 or online at homecomfort.org. And they have 24/7 emergency assistance. Alliance Heating and Air.
Memory Lane Antiques and Vintage is having a grand opening Saturday, February 26th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at their new location in the Shasta Gateway Center at 1773 Highway 273 in Anderson. They will be featuring new and existing vendors, along with a variety of collectibles from around the world, with jewelry, Tiffany lamps, antique desks and dressers, and much more. Free drawings throughout the day. Memory Lane Antiques and Vintage grand opening Saturday, February 26th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at their new location in the Shasta Gateway Center, 1773 Highway 273, Anderson.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. In response to COVID-19, NFI has scheduled online Zoom classroom sessions for CCW and CCW Renewal. These online courses will be followed up with live fire range training, which will complete your certification. Follow-on range training is done with the same great instructors you've come to know and love. Give us a call today at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and remember, it's our right and our responsibility.
I hear people talking bad about the way they have to live here in this country. harping on the wars we fight, griping about the way things ought to be. I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down our country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. They're walking on the fighting side of me. Running down a way of life our fighting men have fought and died to keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song that I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down our country horse, you're walking on the fighting side of me. I read about some squirrely guy who claims that he just don't believe in fighting. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. And when they're running down our country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. They're walking on the fighting side of me. Running down a way of life our fighting men have fought and died to keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song that I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down our country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Running down a way of life our fighting men have fought and died to keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song that I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down our country horse, you're walking on the fighting side of me.
Good morning. You're listening to Battlefield Expressions, The Fighting Side of Me. Merle Haggard, one of our local Northern California individuals who lived here, passed several years ago, but how true it is about our men and women to serve this nation, who serve this country, who fight for the freedom, who fight for the cause, and what it's so important for. And yet there's so many others that never serve, that never step up to the plate and so willing to cut it down, tear it down, take it away. And yet they're not willing to serve or to preserve any part of that. Our guest again this morning is Pat McAleer, and he's a United States Navy subclass petty officer, gunner's mate, and served during the Vietnam War over in the Vietnam area. And good morning, Pat. Again, we talked about your father's service during World War II in Korea and now carrying on into the Vietnam War area. And we just want to say thank you for your service, and we appreciate your service to our nation for serving during that time frame. And we want you to share a little bit about your service with the United States Navy as a gunner's mate on a destroyer and what took place during that time.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity to be here today. I'm just going to mention one final thing about my dad. I was telling Rob off the air that it wasn't all work over there in the Marshall Islands. They had access to beer. The problem was they didn't have access to ice.
Hot beer.
It was hot beer. So what the pilots would do, they'd take the bullets out of their wings of their Corsairs, and they would fill that cavity up with hot beer, and then they would fly it up to about 13,000 feet, and they would cool that beer down. And then they'd bring it down and give it to their crew chief because they wanted those airplanes to work.
That's right. Nothing like a morale builder.
Right.
Cold beer.
Yeah, so I graduated from high school in outside of Fresno in June of 1967. Had a great job lined up. Didn't have any intention of going to college at that time. Just wanted to make a lot of money and buy a fast car. Unfortunately, time and politics got in the way. Vietnam War was heating up, and myself and several of my friends received draft notices. I had met with two friends that decided that they were going to go to Canada, and they tried to talk me into going to Canada with them. I said, I told them, you got to be crazy. My dad was a Marine Corps pilot. He was a Marine World War II vet. And maybe the government won't be able to get me in, up in Canada, but my father will.
That's right.
So I thought I'd take my chances with the Vietnamese. Went down and enlisted in the United States Navy and did 4 years in the service of the Navy. I was very fortunate because I had no idea when I got out of boot camp where they were going to send me or what I was going to be doing, because you didn't have any choice, you know.
Right.
They told you where to go. I fortunately got assigned to a destroyer, the USS Hull, DD-945. It was the last of the all-gun ship destroyers. It was stationed out of San Diego in the 7th Fleet, I got, not too long after I got on there, we were shipped to Westpac, we ended up on the gun line off the coast of Vietnam. I quickly moved from bosun's mate to gunner's mate because they had better bunks down there. And the ship's main battery was 5-inch 54s, the secondary batteries were twin 3-inch 50s, and I operated both of those guns, the 5-inch 54 and the twin 3-inch 50s. Those ships were designed to protect carriers. They weren't really designed to be artillery pieces, but that's the way they were used in Vietnam. We stood off of the gun line in Vietnam and fired support for the 9th Infantry during our first tour over there. We got there just in time for the Tet Offensive. Kind of a funny story about that. One day I was working on pulling the empty case extractor out of the 5-inch 54 gun on the forecastle, and I was standing around with my boss, who was a first-class gunner's mate, and I saw this huge splash off to the starboard, about 15 yards off to the starboard side of the ship, and I ran over to the edge of the ship, and I was looking at my boss. I said, Ed, did you see that fish? And he said, fish? That's not a fish. They're shooting at us.
It was an incoming round.
Yeah. So we immediately went to general quarters, and everybody started ducking. I didn't know they shot at us over here.
And how far out to sea were you at that point?
Not very far.
So you were taking land, just probably regular infantry, either mortars or light artillery.
No, they had light artillery. They actually had guns.
75 millimeter maybe.
Yeah, and they had them in caves. And this was up near Nha Trang, which was south of Da Nang, but it was during the Tet Offensive. We got shot at eight separate occasions over there during the first tour. Second tour, I went over there in 1969. We didn't take any... we spent most of the time up in the Tonkin Gulf actually pulling the pilots out of the water, following the carriers.
Did your ship ever take strikes?
No.
So they were bad aims at that point.
That first one was the closest they came to us.
Yeah, 15 yards is pretty close.
And I was very happy with our skipper. He made that destroyer look like a speedboat. He did not want to bring that boat home with holes in it.
Right.
But, I did two tours in Vietnam, and then I went to the East Coast, where I was supposed to pick up a guided missile destroyer up in Bath, Maine. I was part of a skeleton crew that was going to take it to Hawaii. Fortunately, the shipyard went on strike, and I ended up on an LPH in the Caribbean, and then down to Peru during an earthquake where we medevaced a lot of people. And then to Hawaii, and I was discharged in 1970.
So LPH, that's a landing pad helicopter.
Yes, exactly.
So you guys were helicopter service for that, and then whatever the mission called for you to take care of.
Yeah, they had an earthquake in Peru. We went through the, we weren't supposed to do this. It just happened. We went through the the Panama Canal, went down to Peru, and I served they issued me an M14, and I went in with the doctors and the medical personnel in a place called Chimbote, where we medevaced a lot of the people out of there, and we got liberty in Lima. And at the time, it was a military junta running the country. They didn't have diplomatic relations. But there were a lot of expats in Lima that took care of us for a couple days. Yeah.
You're listening to Battlefield Expressions. Our guest, Pat McAleer, we're talking about his Vietnam service. We'll be right back.
KCNR invites you to join us the second Friday of the month, starting at 8 a.m., for the Gorman Law Hour, featuring local attorney Patrick Gorman, a legal expert when it comes to injured workers, compensation claims, and employee claims. So, if you have a legal question or just wonder whether or not you have a legal issue or problem, talk to Patrick Gorman, attorney at law, during the Gorman Law Hour, starting at 8 a.m. the second Friday of the month on KCNR. Pro Rehab Physical Therapy and Sports Performance is now open at 3673 Eureka Way. Physical therapists Kevin Elo and Rachel Lang have a combined 29 years of experience in helping those who've suffered orthopedic injuries, strains, and sprains. Kevin has worked with the USA Gymnastics team, NFL Combine, and professional BMX riders. He's also helped members of Cirque du Soleil get back into action. Rachel works closely with seniors and is also a group fitness instructor and adept at returning people to an active lifestyle. Both Kevin and Rachel at Pro Rehab Physical Therapy and Sports Performance are accepting new clients. Give them a call today, 530-533-5030. If you are in need of physical therapy, talk to the experts at Pro Rehab Physical Therapy and Sports Performance at 3673 Eureka Way. Call 530-533-5030. That's 530-533-5030 today. Memory Lane Antiques and Vintage is having a grand opening Saturday, February 26th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at their new location in the Shasta Gateway Center at 1773 Highway 273 in Anderson. They will be featuring new and existing vendors, along with a variety of collectibles from around the world, with jewelry, Tiffany lamps, antique desks and dressers, and much more. Free drawings throughout the day. Memory Lane Antiques and Vintage grand opening Saturday, February 26th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at their new location in the Shasta Gateway Center, 1773 Highway 273, Anderson.
Premier, your friendly oil change. Premier in all we do.
Premier Oil Change has been locally owned and operated since we opened in 2006, enjoying long-term relationships with our team members and loyal guests. Many of our team members have worked with us for over 10 years. Many of our certified technicians have logged over 30,000 oil changes, working on hundreds of different vehicle makes and models. In an ever-changing world, we strive to keep up with change. With our extensive training program, it's important to the staff at Premier Oil Change that our customers' cars are well taken care of by experienced, well-trained technicians. So you can depend on your vehicle to get you and your family to your destination. Don't forget that you can earn free oil changes with Premier Rewards. Learn more at PremierOilChange.com or visit us in Palo Cedro. Premier is in the Holiday Market Shopping Center or in Redding on Lake Boulevard next to Waterworks Park or our newest location in Anderson across from Roundtable. Remember, you get a free car wash with every oil change. Premier Oil Change, home of the friendly oil change.
Dear son, it's almost June. I hope this letter catches up with you and finds you well. It's been dry, but they're calling for rain, and everything's the same old same in Johnsonville. Your stubborn old daddy ain't said too much, but I'm sure you know he sends his love. And she goes on in a letter from home.
Good morning. You're listening to Battlefield Expressions. And our guest again this morning is Pat McAleer, Vietnam War veteran, United States Navy gunner's mate. We've just been talking about his father's service in the United States Marine Corps as an F-4U Corsair pilot, captain in the United States Marine Corps. And so, once again, Pat, as we're having the opportunity to talk about your story and your experience serving in the Navy during the Vietnam War, I just want to say thank you again for being here today and sharing your father's story and sharing your story. It's so important that we remember what individuals do when they serve this nation and the sacrifice that they put out there, and your father's service during World War II in Korea and your service during Vietnam. So thank you very much for being here today.
Yeah. Again, thanks for the opportunity. Yeah, I was talking to Rob earlier about my experience in Vietnam. On the destroyer I was on, they had the main batteries were a 5-inch 54, and there was one afternoon I was sitting out there sunbathing, and I was connected to the gun with a helmet and a headphones, but I was outside the gun, sitting there enjoying a cigarette and enjoying the sun, and all of a sudden, a jet, a fighter jet, came up off of the back of the ship and buzzed us. And I swear to God, it wasn't more than 20, 30 feet above the ship. Well, but when that happened, the guns all went into automatic mode, so they all swung around to train on the jet.
All the radar picked him up.
Yeah, exactly. And unfortunately, I was still outside the gun, connected with my helmet and a lead to the gun, so I got swung around like...
Pulled by your helmet and cord.
Yeah. So that was pretty scary, I'll tell you.
So that the guns didn't go off?
No.
Because you have to manually fire those.
Yeah.
Or set them to automatic fire.
Yeah, and this jet that buzzed us was obviously an American.
Right.
Screwing with us, really.
Some Navy jock.
Yeah. Somebody
was... Fly Navy.
Was a little bored, I guess. But, that was a scary episode. Later on, towards the end of my first tour over there, I was promoted to a third-class gunner's mate, and as were two others. And there was only a billet of for one third-class gunner's mate on that ship, so two of us had to go. And at that time, during the Vietnam War, I think it was called Operation Mark. No, I can't remember what it was now, but we were using swift boats and PBRs, and the swift boat is a little bigger boat, but the PBR was a wooden boat, maybe somewhat similar to, although smaller than the...
About half the size of a PT boat.
Yes, half the size of a PT boat. It had twin 50 caliber up front and generally a twin 50 caliber in the back. So what they were looking for was Navy sailors that were either bosun's mates or gunner's mates. The bosun's mates would operate would drive the boat, and then you had the gunner's mates operating the guns. And the PBR school was in Alameda, California, and they were going to ship two of us to PBR school. So of the three of us, I didn't want to go to PBR school. The other two guys went, and one of them was a real close friend of mine. His name was Andy Rice, and he was killed over there. And I never did find, ultimately I did find out how he died. And the other one was wounded. So those jobs were dangerous jobs, very dangerous. One day I'm driving down Hilltop, much in the 1980s, and I have my wife and my children in my car, and I look over in front of one of the hotels, and I see this PBR sitting on a trailer. And I looked at my wife, and I said, "That's a PBR, and I've got to go see what this is about." Well, they were having a reunion there of these folks that served Vietnam and served on these PBRs, and I met one guy, and this was a very small community,
right.
I started passing my friend's name that was killed over around, and one of them recognized him, and that's how I found out how Andy was killed. And he was operating a twin 50 on the back side of the PBR and was killed by a sniper. So those were dangerous jobs. Yeah.
Well, PBRs are up close and personal, and then as the river's narrow, they're right in the brush. You can't even see through the canopy. It's so dark and so thick.
Exactly.
That's why they do a lot of that training in Mississippi in the bayous, because it's the exact as going into those areas where those PBRs that they still use. I mean, a lot of what we have right now are in the Middle East, so they're on wide open spaces.
Right.
But a lot of times you're even in the desert when you're along the Euphrates River, the first 50 yards is all brush and trees and vines and everything else, and then it goes to desert. And the enemy loves to hide and sit in those dark places.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, that was, well, if you ever saw that movie, what was the name of that Vietnam movie?
I was thinking of
I love the smell
of napalm in the morning.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. There were some PBRs in that movie.
Yeah, in fact, they used the PBRs to go up the delta there at the very end of the movie. And I'm lost for the title of that right now. Everybody else is going, hey, this is what it is.
And that Apocalypse Now?
That's Apocalypse Now. Yes,
now. Thank correct. You.
I think that's why we have an engineer. Quick look up.
Yeah, we had those PBRs and the swift boats would come out to the destroyers all the time. And they'd be trading souvenirs to the sailors on the destroyers in exchange for ice cream.
Priorities.
Right.
A little touch of home.
Ice cream or ice. On a destroyer, they had one ice-making machine, and over in Vietnam, they kept a guard on that ice-making machine all the time, because the sailors were always trying to break in there into the ice machine to get ice.
Right.
You know, but the officers wanted it for themselves.
Of course. There's a chain of command for a reason sometimes.
That's right.
And the rest of us are just kind of out on the outside looking in.
Mm-hmm.
So... Well, we're coming down to our last couple of minutes here, Pat. And if you had anything else you wanted to add concerning your father or for your service during Vietnam or, you know, your veteran's outlook here, your point of view here in our own community. I know you have your own business. You're getting ready to retire.
And, yes, I am.
And so maybe you made a recent donation to the museum of your aviation art and artifacts of your father. If you're looking on the website right now, we have a picture of your dad's FRU Corsair right here in honor of his service. And that's going to be on the wall on display in the museum, honoring your father and the other pilots that served along with Colonel Sweat, who received the Medal of Honor. And it's always a privilege for us to be able to receive these items, clean them up, and then restore them and put them back on display for future generations in our community.
Yeah, I had the unique opportunity and honor to meet Colonel Sweat, who was a Corsair pilot. As it turned out, he was also the squadron commander of VMF 914, which was a reserve squadron located in Oakland. So he was my dad's squadron commander in between World War II and Korea. So my dad knew Colonel Sweat.
It's a small world.
Mm-hmm. My dad also practiced law, and most of his career was in Fresno, and knew Pappy Boyington really well. Colonel Sweat didn't have any much good to say about Pappy. But Pappy Boyington, despite all of his flaws, was a hell of a pilot. He really was. He was a great pilot. If he had not been shot down in January of 44, I think it was, he would have probably been the leading ace.
Of World War I and World War II.
Yes.
Eddie Rickenbacker was the lead ace for World War II at 27 kills.
Yeah. When Pappy Boyington was shot down, he had 22 kills, two or three of which was with the Flying Tigers before he entered the war. But Boyington was a member of the downtown club in Fresno, as was my dad, so they knew each other pretty well.
Yeah, those guys hung out together pretty much when they came back.
Yep.
Like-minded community, and they didn't have to say very much. They just knew where they'd been, what took place, and what happened. So,
yeah, when Boyington was shot down, they didn't know he was actually captured by the Japanese and was actually still alive as a prisoner in Japan. So when they awarded him, I believe this is correct, they awarded him the Medal of Honor posthumously. But he turned out he was still alive.
He'd been in a POW camp at the very end of the war.
Yes.
Pat, we're coming up on our last seconds here. I just want to say thank you again for being here today. Thank you for sharing your father's story, and thank you for your service and sharing your story with us.
I appreciate you've been listening the opportunity.
To thank Battlefield you. Expressions. We will see you next time.
Put it in my shirt, pick up my gun and get back to work. And it keeps me driving on, waiting on letters from home.
KCNR, Shasta, Reading.